So our scriptures are filled with depths and breadth that we barely touch upon in our journey through the three-year cycle we call our lectionary. Though we do get huge swathes of Bible stories, there's much we don't hear unless we attend midweek services or follow the weekday readings in our own home. Not only that, but there's so much of our scripture that we take at face value, not recognizing the layer upon layers, the imagery, the culture, the context from which they emerged, and the further context which caused them to be recorded and passed down from generation to generation. Add to that the editing, the transmission, the compilation, the translation, and the agendas behind those who decided what was what we now call canonical or authorized scriptures. And there is no end to the learning that we could do and still find ourselves barely scraping the surface of the meaning within and behind our scriptures. Isn't that exciting? No, I mean, we can either give up now, knowing that we'll never get to the end of it, or we can see it as an almost limitless opportunity to engage with the wisdom, the stories, the meanings, the mistakes, the wrestling, and the hopes of our forebears in faith. And notice I've said nothing yet about the divine revelation that is within our scriptures. And I do believe that these pages are infused with glimpses of God, sometimes only tiny glimpses, sometimes just whispers from the voice of the Spirit, sometimes truths which leap out of us and, to quote another document, seem self-evident. Sometimes there are nuggets for which we have to scramble and dig deep. And this lengthy preamble comes from something that surfaced as we discussed these passages earlier in the week, but particularly the passage from 2 Samuel that is set for today. It was some years after I was ordained, having been through a couple theology degrees and a postgrad diploma for ministry, that something fell into place for me. It was through a wise-cracking and very wise archdeacon, David Gunn Johnson, someone who is obviously my role model. He caused something very significant to fall into place for me. The stories in our Hebrew scriptures are never just about one person. Even when it seems that David or Solomon or Samson or Elijah or Elisha, Samuel, whoever is the star of the show, those who recorded the stories, those who told the stories, those who would have heard the stories would have realized they were never just about one person. For within the cultural understanding of our Hebrew forebears, there was a deep awareness of how all things are connected. And within the culture of Israel, the three foundations of society were the throne, the temple, and the prophets. They may have been independent and all very individual, but they were deeply interconnected, their purpose interwoven. Their mission was shared. And that mission was to bring in the reign, the kingdom, the way of the divine, the state of being called shalom, the way of wholeness, of justice, and of healing. The throne, the monarch, is about the government and leadership in the daily sphere. The temple about the leadership of the ritual life of the nation, and the prophets were the wild voice of the Spirit, the disturbing, challenging, uplifting voice of the divine, particularly to those in power. Now, just a quick aside, it's really important that I say this here. I am not advocating for the intermixing of church and state. I firmly believe in the separation of the two, and as someone who began their formation and ministry in a state church, the Church of England, I can see some advantages for the church and the responsibility it holds for all people in that governance model. But I can see so many more disadvantages for the privileging of one religious group to have a particular role and an authority in a country. So I am not arguing for the integration of religion into state governance, but I do want to offer some context to the biblical story that we have today. End of PSA. So bearing in mind this integrated mindset in the cultural context of our scriptures, when the stories talk about the intersections of these worlds, such as in today's passage, when the prophet Nathan confronts the king, David, it's not just talking about Nathan and David. The stories are never just about one person, or even two. The health of the king, the integrity of the monarch, is seen as representative of the health of the community, the whole community, of the nation, and indeed of the health of the land. We see this more in the story of the unjust King Ahab, for when he strays from the ways of the commandments, from the ways of Adonai, the land is under a drought and famine for many years. So here we have a story of the abuse of power, and about those who abuse power being called to account, and that the consequences of such wrongdoing are felt for a long time. In this case, represented by David's lust and his infidelity and the orchestration of the murder of Uriah the Hittite. So we may well ask, why is this story included in our scriptures? Well, I think it's a healthy corrective to the hero worship that we're all prone to fall into in the face of charismatic leaders. I think it's part of the deliberate way in which our scriptures often offer nuanced and unvarnished accounts of even the great and the good in the stories we hear. More than that, I think it's seeking to explain why things go badly wrong later in the story, when David's children turn against him. A civil war threatens. Oops, spoiler alert, that's coming in the weeks ahead, so I'll leave the rest of the story for that. But now to return to the thoughts of my preamble. We don't know, and it can't be proven or disproven that this, what the historical veracity of these accounts is. We don't know how many of these stories have their basis in real events, as we would talk of them, and how many are mythic constructs. And that's okay, unless we've all turned into biblical literalists in the recent past. We realize that these stories are here to teach us something, that they are filled with truths and not necessarily literally true. That's probably not going to shock many of us. So what is the truth, or if you prefer, the wisdom that we can take away from this passage at this time, in this place? For the wisdom we find might be quite different the next time we read it, together or alone, the next time we hear it, the next time we discuss this passage. I think for our community, the wisdom we are being offered is exactly what we began with. It's not just about one person. This came to me in sharp relief as I saw the fallout around the Olympics. It seems the right wing are desperate to find things to be angry about at these Olympics. Which particular fallout, I hear you ask? To which I will reply, I know, right? With plenty of eye rolling. Well, this was the sad, and I will say despicable, response by anti-trans campaigners to the victory of Imane Khelif in the women's boxing. The vilification of someone who falls outside of the box of gender expectation, which some would like to contain women within. A cisgendered woman, probably with DSD, differing sexual development, accused first and falsely of being a man, and then of having an unfair advantage because of her biological makeup. As if Olympians don't have advantages through their biological makeup. And it's easy to get into the weeds of this discussion, but in short, it has been hijacked by the ill-intentioned and taken on by the ill-informed, as a moment to quote-unquote protect women in sport. But it's not, it's obviously not about women in sport. It's not even about Imane Khelif. It's about a growing rise in intolerance, hate speech, and misinformation, which even some smart people I know have jumped on the bandwagon of, as they have been convinced by half-truths and blatant lies of the justice of standing up to the woke brigade who will allow anything in the name of equity. It's never about one person or two. Another woman boxer, Lin Yuting, is finding herself viciously attacked by those who wish to police women's bodies and identities and deny the variety and fluidity of gender and sex. And we see this also in politics, where people point to the wickedness of Trump without addressing the hatred and the intolerance and the lies and the deeply repressive agenda of those who surround the former president and who have enabled his rise, particularly the religious right. We have been distracted by the cult of individualism, and we have forgotten that the best and worst people are not alone in what they achieve, for good or ill. I believe at this time we are being called again as a community to be discerning, to be wise, not to join in with the clamor of dissent and disagreement so beloved in our contemporary society, but to learn instead to listen to the prophets, to the breath of the Spirit, to the wisdom of both our forebears in faith and our siblings in the pew next to us. We are being called to stand for justice and to live in love. Or as the author of the letter to the Ephesians finishes with today, speaking the truth in love, we must grow up in every way into the one who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knitted together by every ligament with which it is equipped, as each part is working properly, promotes the body's growth in building itself up in love. Each one of us has a part. Each one of us is important. Each one of us is beloved. And it's together we can be built up in love. Thanks be to God.